Hello, this is Jonathan Mosen. Synth the Voice of Ontario, Canada was the first company to produce a screen reader for Windows back in 1992, Slimware Window Bridge. I spoke with David Costishan, the president of Synth the Voice, on the Blind Line of Saturday the 21st of August 1999. We spoke about Synth the Voice's history and exciting new developments just around the corner. We began by talking about how Synth the Voice was formed.
Synth the Voice was incorporated in January of 1983. At that time, I incorporated the company after completing a few degrees in university in which I was headed toward the field of rehabilitation counseling. And prior to losing my vision in 1978, I was heavily involved in mathematics and science. And so that desire never left me, and I seemed to merge those skills and experiences along with the fact of being blind myself and the rehabilitation studies that I had undertaken, and found myself in a position where PCs were just starting to become available to the normal consumer, and I was approached and asked in how this kind of technology could possibly be modified to be used by people with special needs. And I was working for the government here at the time. And talking computers were not out yet. We were basically looking at systems that could spell but couldn't read whole words. And I was involved in some research projects for some other companies at the time. And that evolved into a full-time interest, and felt that it was something that I'd want to pursue on a full-time basis. So I left the job with the government and started Synth the Voice Computers.
And given that the computer industry was so different, we were, as you say, just getting into DOS machines being made available. What were the primary objectives of the company when it was first formed?
When it was first formed, our initial objective was to design a synthesizer that could be plugged into a PC. When I first started the company, we were still working in the CPM environment, and we're using that as a development platform to write some of our code for DOS, because we didn't have a synthesizer that could run under DOS at the time, in late 82 when we first started, and 83 when we officially incorporated. Our initial objectives were to design that type of synthesizer that could be plugged in as a card into the PC along with a DOS-level screen reading program integrated into it.
And so you came out with a DOS product relatively quickly?
Yes, we produced a circuit board that originally was designed to go into Hewlett-Packard HP150 desktop computers. And at the same time, we started to develop a card for the IBM PC, because no one knew at that time that the IBM PC was really going to have the magnetism that it, and gross market margin that it was going to end up having. So we developed it on the Hewlett-Packard platform and then moved it over to IBM, both running under DOS. And we wrote a screen reading program, and we introduced it as the Synthetic Language Interface Module, and came up with the abbreviation SLIM for that. And that later evolved into splitting the software to control other synthesizers, as we went through a real boom in the market in the early 80s, where more and more synthesizers were being independently developed, and people were looking for software that could control them. So we split our software away from our dedicated hardware and changed the name of the DOS product to Slimware. And eventually we moved from there into the Windows environment, and the product name moved forward into Slimware Window Bridge.
It's really
interesting. That's where the Slim part of everything originally came from.
Because you guys have always been at the forefront of whatever's happened in the computer industry, and often the first to get a product to market.
We were, and it was a little known fact. Based in Canada, there was a relatively small market for the technology compared to markets like the U.S. And we originally felt that we should establish ourselves business-wise in our own country and then expand from there. And after several years of understanding that the market in Canada is spread out so far, because Canada is such a large geographic expanse, that it was extremely expensive to go from the center of the country, basically where we're located, to go to Vancouver would be a six-hour flight, or to go to the East Coast, it would be equally as far. So there were small pockets of people that were just starting to become interested in computers, but there really wasn't a concentrated population of employed blind people that would be in a type of environment where they'd be looking for PCs. And it wasn't until we pointed our direction into Europe and the UK and into the US that things started to change.
Marketing's always an issue, isn't it? Because you can have people with lots of brains to make very clever software, but it's a whole different science, again, if I can use that term, to make sure that people know about the product and that it's marketed in a way that entices people to give it a try.
Yes, and admittedly, that's been our weakness, and we've done a lot to address that in the next generation of our products. But our internal little joke was, we felt that we had arguably one of the best software products on the market, but it was our little secret. And we really had to find a way to market the product effectively. And once again, the marketing approach that's used in Canada is totally different than you would find in the U.S. Typically in Canada, people do not like aggressive marketing techniques. They would rather you put your effort into the quality of the product and then let the consumer decide for themselves which best meets their needs. And they do not like an in-your-face, aggressive, bold, brash sort of approach to marketing in general. But in the U.S., after taking time to study the market more and speak with marketing people in general, they are more toward the whoever beats the drum the loudest gets the attention. And it was a difficult transition for us to start to accept that. We felt that if the quality was put into the product, the consumer would know about it and be able to decide that that's what they wanted. But it seems that you need to be more aggressive than that, and it's taken us some time to learn these types of things.
Having said that, though, if you read some of the email lists around in the blindness community, there are a number of people in the US who are quite critical of the market leader because they say that their marketing practices are too aggressive.
Yes, and that's been one of the reasons it held us back from being more aggressive and spending the money on the marketing side and becoming overly commercial. I think that there are obviously exceptions to the rule, and we are definitely seeing, as you've just mentioned, a number of people that felt that products can be shoved down your throat, that everywhere you turn, you can have a product in your face, and it at some point becomes a negative as opposed to a positive. But I think that when you look at market leaders, you can't deny the fact that they've been effective in getting their product name known to the public in general. It's now a question of whether that technique is taken too far or not.
Do you think that there's a bit of parochialism in consumers at times, in the sense that are some people in the US, for example, reluctant to buy Canadian if they can buy American?
Yes, that's the we've always been confronted with that. In fact, being so close to the U.S. and generally the way the markets are driven in North America in general, the U.S. policy is to buy U.S. And in Canada, there are relatively few manufacturers in any given field compared to the U.S. So Canadians are led to believe that we have the natural resources. We sell those resources to the U.S., they develop them into products, and they sell them back to Canadians. and therefore technology coming out of the U.S. has to be better than technology coming out of our own country. And that has to do with the general market, not just the adaptive technology market. We're really one of only a couple of companies in Canada that are doing actual design work in this field. But having said that, there is also a lot of incentives in the U.S. for the government, for example, and the education market to purchase American-made products. For example, if a company, and at least one of the market leaders has done this, if a company in our field is owned by a minority, that being female or Indian descent, or and there's a number of other categories, disabled, they can apply for a certain type of government status. This government status, once it's been given to you as a company, then allows major contractors, like major telephone companies or PC companies, if they bid on a job where they have to supply 50,000 PCs and there are 1,000 blind employees, if they purchase it under subcontract from one of these companies, they get bonus points back. And these bonus points can be turned in at the end of the year to equate to massive tax revenues. So they get tax cuts by buying from these companies. And of course, only U.S. companies can qualify for that special jurisdiction. So it's another incentive for government departments and education and agencies to purchase from a company that's given this designation.
And this whole thing about natural resources going overseas and then being processed, as it were, it must be a systemic issue for Canada's economy as a whole, because if you don't add value to your natural resources, you're not actually maximizing your GDP as much as you could.
That's right. And that's been something that's been discussed for years. If you look at the Canadian economy, if we take something as simple as a toaster, there may be three or four companies in Canada that are involved in making toasters. However, if you go across the border, you'll see that there are 200 companies making toasters. Now, they export them to Canada using our raw materials, and all we're doing is employing people to remove the minerals and natural resources from the ground, send it across to the U.S. All the jobs in the manufacturing sector are there. They sell them back here, and we, or they build companies here that are involved in nothing but sales, and they bring in Americans under their own company names to fulfill those jobs. So generally the employability factor is a detriment to Canada as well. And this is something that's been debated for some time now. First of all, do we need 200 different types of toasters on the market? And secondly, should we say to the U.S. companies, if you want to manufacture products out of our wealth of natural resources, why don't we have you build a company here, employ Canadians to manufacture the device, and then sell it in Canada? And the auto industry is taking the lead in that type of market. We have all the major automobile manufacturers doing that kind of thing under an agreement with the U.S.
I just can't recall now, is Canada a signatory to NAFTA?
Yes.
Yeah, so this is another version of the giant sucking sound that Ross Perot was talking about.
Yes.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Coming back to Window Bridge, I'm interested in how Synthevoice managed to become the first out there, by some considerable margin incidentally, to have a Windows 3.1 product available. When did the alarm bells start to ring for you that said DOS is dead and blind people have got to get with Windows and we've got to make it happen?
In 1982, we purchased the development kit for Windows 3.0. And we began to look at it in the mid-1982 time frame. I basically am in charge of new projects for the company, and I sat down and I saw that there were 1992, there were approximately 15 different DOS-level screen readers on the market, and the gap between each product with respect to its features and capabilities was so narrow that it became product loyalty to certain companies, but they really essentially all did the same thing. They may have called the feature something different or executed the command slightly differently, but there really wasn't any growth. It looked like the market was very stagnant. And we took a look at Windows 3.0 and thought that this had some possibilities, but if you recall back in 1992 or so, 1991, there was a real split in the market whether the market was going to go toward Windows with 3.1 or if it was going to go to OS 2. And we began to research development of our product for both environments to see which one would be the most lucrative, because the general market really hadn't made a decision yet prior to 3.1 being released. And at the time, when we contacted Microsoft and said we were interested in doing something, they sent us a complimentary developer's kit. And when we contacted IBM, they wanted thousands of dollars for a complimentary developer's kit. So our first knee-jerk reaction was to take a look at the developer's kit for the product that we received at no charge, and we thought that Microsoft as a company specializing in the software area may have a tendency to take the lead in the next operating system because of the popularity of DOS itself. So we decided that if we were going to exist as a company and flourish, that we have to find something that everyone else said was basically impossible. And at the time, if you were to poll the various companies involved in developing screen readers, they all said that it could not be done, that there were too many gaps, there were too many problems. Microsoft themselves would have to be heavily involved in giving out information. And when we began to research it, we found that we could do it on our own. And essentially, we designed Window Bridge and contacted Microsoft in late May, early June of 1992, which was about 10 days after Windows 3.1 had officially been released. And we told them that we had a version for the blind. And Microsoft laughed and said, "No, you mean you want to develop one?" And we said, "No, we have one." And they were in shock, so they asked for a copy of the program, and we shipped it down to them. And what really amazed them was they had never heard of us other than a request for the developer's kit, and were wondering how we figured out how to do the interface, because we hadn't gone to them and asked them a single question. We decided to do it all on our own because we felt if we crossed the line and became dependent on Microsoft or another party, then our development would be greatly affected by the time frame that they had to assist us with the project, and we would always be at their mercy. So we felt that the only way to develop a product like this would be to teach ourselves to be able to do it independently.
And when was the product officially released to the market?
It was released on June 15th, 1992.
Mm. That's impressive. I mean, that, as I say, there's still a considerable margin between when you released something and when anyone else did.
Yeah. What was fun about the project and odd at the same time was that we had to develop a lot of concepts. We, for example, a lot of standard sorts of things that you do today, for example, the reading cursor that you see on most screen readers is tied to the movement of the mouse. The measurement of an icon that was not already identified, we chose to have it identified by the height of the icon and how many pixels high it was. There were more conceptual sorts of aspects to the design that we have to stop and think, all right, here's the situation. Now you're in a screen where you cannot move, a line at a time. You cannot move a word at a time because it's a scattered array of buttons and words. How would you move from one of these items to another? So we developed the concept of moving an item at a time, and then being able to skip over anything that was not an icon, and then just move an icon at a time, and to make it just single command. So we had to develop a lot of standards because we didn't have anybody to copy. And what happened was, while we were developing these standards, other companies said that this was a way of fast tracking, and they borrowed a lot of these concepts and massaged them into fit into their own formats, and they were able to spend more time on stability and other issues because we were split between doing the off-screen model and developing concepts for navigation and identification of objects. So while it was fun to be the pioneers in certain areas, it also had a tendency to work against us.
Yes, I can still recall when a demo of Window Bridge was made available, and I think I must have had to call into the Synthevoice BBS and download it in those days.
Yeah.
That was pretty expensive. And I just remember, as probably many blind people do, being absolutely startled that here was this hostile environment that you previously couldn't get any speech out of at all that was suddenly starting to come to life. And there were some conceptual issues, and it was a kind of a first-generation product, but you got feedback in Windows. I just found that remarkable. And you must have had a lot of reaction to that release.
Yes. People were shocked. In fact, if we look back to some of the concepts that we implemented in the very first generation, the public insisted that the only way you could navigate the mouse pointer around the screen was with a physical device, and that they wanted not only verbal and braille feedback when you move to an object, but also they needed other orientation, such as how far they were from the left or the right, or top or bottom, how fast they were moving. So based on that, our original versions, and right up until the current versions, and the features are still there, where if you used a physical device such as a mouse, if you held the shift key, when you move, you would hear a series of ascending and descending tones. There would be one range of tones for horizontal movement and another for vertical movement, so that you could hear where you were in the audio spectrum in relation to where you were to the edge of the window or the edge of the screen. And if you were moving in a skewed manner, you would hear both sets of tones playing back to let you know that you were moving on an angle. But to allow the user to move in a straight line, we had a keyboard command that would lock into vertical or horizontal tracking, that if you used a physical mouse and traveled and moved up and down, even if you could not physically move in a straight line, we would lock the mouse pointer to make sure it was guided perfectly straight. Kinds of concepts were put in there because the public, we wanted to navigate directly from the keyboard, and the public said, you can't do that. It has to be with the mouse, because that's the way sighted people do things. So we pursued both approaches simultaneously. We developed our mouse pad for moving lines, words, characters, items, and icons at a time, clicking the left and right mouse button from the numeric pad, and using the same orientation to the keys as the IBM orientation for navigating a normal DOS or a Windows insertion pointer. But at the same time, we had to pursue the support of touch screens and with audio and braille feedback, and also using a tracking ball or a mouse.
And did you do a lot of the programming on the first versions of Window Bridge?
My job was primarily in the design area. My programming skills were just self-taught, and they're nowhere near what's required to do programming of this level of sophistication. But we have a very talented engineer in the office by the name of Neil Cooper, who really did not have experience with the blind, but could interpret any designs and concepts that were given to him and then make it work that way. So my part of the design was to say, here is the key or key combination on the keyboard. Here is how it has to feel to the user. It's positioned here and works in combination with these other related commands so that the user knows that there are a group of commands that are physically related to each other in the same place on the keyboard. And then, since I couldn't see, there were a number of activities and things that were happening in the Windows screen that I wasn't aware of, and yet Neil could interpret those and give that information to me and say, you also need to be able to handle this situation and that situation. So the two of us would collaborate, and basically between the two of us, we came up with the design.
So you as a blind person are saying to this talented engineer, you know, these are the frustrations that I'm facing, and he can observe how you're interacting or not interacting with Windows and respond accordingly.
Yes, and at the same time, I was being taught the technical ins and outs of Windows for things that I had never been exposed to in my life. DOS was so easy compared to this at first. It just seemed overwhelming that you now had to deal with exploding windows and windows that the same window wouldn't always appear in the same location on the screen, and it would overlap and partially cover other windows, and the highlights weren't really highlights. They were different color combinations, and as video resolutions were going through their growth process, we weren't dealing with 16 colors anymore. We were dealing with 16 million, and we not only had to think of the character itself, but there were so many other things. We needed to know the point size. We needed to know the font. All of this information, being in a WYSIWYG type of environment, was now relevant to the user. And we had to come up with ways of portraying that information without overwhelming the blind user. If you move to a character, you didn't want to be told the position of the character itself, the color of the foreground, the color of the background, the point size, and any other attributes all at once. That would be too overwhelming to the user. So we had to take a look at whether we had filters that turned on or off, or that we had different commands that would give you selective feedback that you could choose from. So all of these designs were not required in a DOS environment, but became imperative to using Windows.
And how many people work for SynthaVoice now?
There's five of us.
So you've achieved a lot.
Yeah. We're a very small company, and we use that to our advantage in that I've dealt with very large companies in the adaptive technology business, and to have a design change made, it's a matter of scheduling a meeting, having the meeting with one group of people, having another meeting with the engineers, having a third meeting to schedule the design, have another meeting with the people who do documentation, and then have another meeting with the people who are involved in technical support, who then feed back to the engineers that, no, that's not going to work because, and then giving them that information. We can sit down as a group, and we have regular staff meetings, or somebody will just wander into my office and say, pull up a chair and say, I've got a great idea for a new feature. And we sit down, and in 10 minutes or 15 minutes, we bang out the idea, we massage the idea into how it can be diversified and how it could fit in comfortably with the other concepts. And the engineer sits there and listens. I write out the description of how it should work, and by the end of the day, the feature's done.
And you do release minor updates quite regularly.
Yes, we... In the last year, we released, I believe, about 8 updates, all containing new features.
Let me ask you about copy protection, because many end users, when I do these interviews, they drop me a note and they say, you know, ask about copy protection for the vendors that do it, because it's a nightmare. Mm-hmm. You know, Windows crashes so often, and you lose your key and things like that. Why does SynthaVoice persist with it when it's clearly a pain in the neck?
Yeah, it is a pain in the neck. And being, if we were in a mass market where we could absorb the cost of piracy and so on, which we cannot deny its existence, If we could build that into the price of the product, where lost sales were compensated for, there would not be the need for that. However, just last week, I believe it was, in Germany, trucks were pulled over and a warehouse was discovered with $55 million worth of pirated Microsoft software in Germany. And they were just copying the software on CDs and selling them. And there's a mainstream product, and look at the impact that $55 million U.S. worth of merchandise. And Germany is not one of the world leaders when it comes to software piracy. And once you have a product that is copy protected in one area geographically and not in others, then you're treating people unfairly. It's an ongoing debate. I wish we didn't have to do it. I really don't have accurate figures on the number of people in our business as consumers that have illegal copies of software, but I think if you look at even the applications they have, there are a significant number of users that borrow copies of programs from other users. And in order to make this whole research project financially viable, we have to ensure that we can keep the cost of the product down, where people that don't get external funding from their employers or agencies or their schools or whatever can afford to purchase the product. And at the same time, we would have to make sure that we're selling enough copies of the product to maintain its development and growth and support properly. So that's where we stand on all this. Our copy protection is very passive compared to some, in that if you run a scan disk or whatever, you do not lose your fingerprint for a licensed copy. We give extra fingerprints on the master disk, and if you lose all of your fingerprints, you phone our toll-free line, and in under a minute we can give you another group of installations at no cost over the phone.
Sure. There are some people that say, though, that the copy protection scheme actually only hurts the legitimate users, because any copy protection scheme can be broken by pirates if they really want to, who have the technical know-how to do it, and it's the legitimate users that don't have the technical know-how that are being penalized.
Yes, and our next generation of product will be even less invasive on the consumer, so that you won't even really know that there is copy protection there.
So, yes, I'm looking forward to coming to the next generation issues, because there are little bits getting out into the industry at the moment. But before I do that, it's interesting that because you guys are always out there first, I suppose that you've had to react to changing market demands as they become more familiar with Windows. And the example you gave about people wanting to use the physical mouse illustrates that. Do you think that the way that Window Bridges had to grow in response to new features and things has made the interface quite complex in some respects?
Up till this time it has, but what we've done is we've maintained a database of every comment, question, or query, or suggestion that's ever been made to us since 1992. And we have, in the process of getting to the next generation of products, we have done a lot of soul searching and grouped these suggestions and looked at trends and the number of requests for certain capabilities, and also the deletion of features that are no longer relevant as Windows changes itself, and have remolded the product to make it ridiculously simple. I think the new version of the product is so ridiculously simple to use that it takes under a minute to install. It installs right within Windows, but as we go through it, I can spend as much time as you want giving you specifics We're not keeping it a secret, but we can tell people about the new generation of products and
right.
and what they're capable of.
Well, we seem to have progressed nicely to that point, so give us all the details because there are people very eager to hear all this.
Okay, the next generation of WindowBridge products are going to be known as WindowBridge 2000. They will come in several different versions. There will be a version for Windows 95 and 98. There will be another version for Windows NT 4, and we will be the first screen reader on the market for Windows 2000. And you can also get a suite of products that works on all four, 95, 98, NT 4, and Windows 2000. Now, the product is totally written from scratch. Every single line of code has been written from scratch from the ground up on the new products. We did not patch or modify anything in the existing WindowBridge. We made the interface in some respects very similar for existing users so that they can make the transition as easily as possible. They can even modify the interface themselves to look and feel the same way as the older generations of WindowBridge have. It's a pure Windows 32-bit application. It's installed from within Windows, as a normal Windows application is. It is removed, just like a normal Windows application, from add remove programs. When it's installed, it will appear on your desktop. It will also have a hotkey that will start it at any time. It also has a sleep mode that will put it to sleep in case you're using an OCR product with its own speech and you don't want WindowBridge to interfere. So you can make our product dormant. You can run it whenever you want, and you can take it out of memory anytime you want. It is everything is 32-bit and Unicode, so that every minor detail of the product, even down to every dialogue on what can be typed into edit boxes, fully uses the Unicode standard.
Can you explain what that standard is?
Sorry?
Can you explain a bit about that standard?
Yeah, well, it's a very, very large character set. If we look back to the DOS environment where we had 256 characters, think of Unicode in that same respect, except it has... I'm trying to remember how many characters are in it. There's 20 or 30,000?
Mm-hmm.
It incorporates all languages, all accents. It's the standard for generating text that applications are now gravitating toward very quickly.
Okay.
And so in Windows 3.1, we used to have Wingding fonts and Webding fonts and Ibsidic fonts and TrueType fonts. Now everything is converging into a Unicode font.
Excellent.
So it allows you to generate any character, whether it be an accented text or math symbols, all sorts of groups of symbols, including Chinese symbols and so on. So we've fully adopted that character set to make it possible to work in as many different non-English environments as possible. And our product even allows you, when a character appears on your screen that we don't recognize in the Unicode table, all you do is position your cursor there and press a hotkey. It takes it, opens the dialog, puts it there, and asks you, what do you want to call this character? What phonetic would you like to output to your synthesizer? And what dot pattern would you like to see on your Braille display representing this character?
Oh. What about DOS support?
So it's incredibly diverse. Sorry?
Is DOS support still available in the new version?
Yes. There will be a DOS, our DOS screen reader that was part of the integrated package of WindowBridge, known as Slimware, will be a separate executable for running a DOS environment.
Okay.
Now, the product will work with Braille displays as well as synthesizers, and within the control panel, when you load our product, there is a menu heading called Modes. You move there, and there is your very first choice is Device. When you open that dialog, it gives you a list of all your Braille displays, and it's just point and shoot. Just move down the list box and tab and tell it what port you're on, and then control tab, and it gives a list of the synthesizers, both hardware and software, and you move, and you can change devices at any time from within the application.
Right, so there's no complex install procedure for each device that you may want.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Now, when you install the product, it comes up speaking in the Microsoft speech, and you just simply go into the control panel and change it to any other device you want, and you can change it on the go, and every synthesizer, as you know, has its own range of pitch rates and volumes and so on. And it was always a bit of a pain if you had your voice set for, let's say, a DeckTalk synthesizer and then switched to a DoubleTalk or a Keynote where the voice sounded strange. Or an Apollo was a good example where the range of pitches was totally different than many of the other devices. So what happens is the new Window Bridge maintains all of the voice-related settings for each synthesizer. So you can have global settings, and you can have application-specific parts to your configuration settings. So if I am currently using an Accent synthesizer, and I go into the dialogue and change it to a Keynote synthesizer, it will automatically load the voice settings that I prefer for my Keynote.
And documentation, is there a new, I guess there must have been a rewritten manual as well.
Yes, totally rewritten manual. It's all, our help is all HTML and 32-bit. So when you go to our help, you can be in our control panel, for example, and move to any option in the control panel, press function key number 1, it instantly links to all the relevant parts of the manual that discuss the use of that feature. And the manual is in Word format. You can read the manual itself. You can also go into a generic help mode that will give you help on subjects instead of features. And when you go to any application, there is a hotkey for application-specific help that will give you helpful hints saying that there are macros within Window Bridge, let's say, that have been designed to enhance certain features, and here's what the keys are. We recommend that you maybe maximize your window when using this application. Anything that will enhance the performance of Window Bridge with that application will come up with a hotkey at any time.
It's interesting that you say that, because there are some comments that, for example, one screen reader is far too dependent on scripting or macros, and that another one is okay, but it needs a little bit of macro help to make it really go. And Window Bridge seems to have a combination of both, that it has menu-driven configuration options, but if you want to get into macros, they're there as well.
Yes, we've done that. We did not feel that the average consumer wanted to or had the time or the skill to become proficient in scripting languages. So we opted not to follow that path. Remember, again, that being ahead of the other screen readers, we had to choose our macro decisions, whether they would exist at all, and what they would follow. And it was our feeling in talking to hundreds of consumers at the time of using DOS screen readers that the most popular application that they used was WordPerfect 5.1. And they felt comfortable in the macro capabilities of WordPerfect because it basically recorded your keystrokes and played them back, and you knew what you were recording, and you could go and edit them at any time. So we use that as a general guideline for our macro recorder and editor, so that when you looked at a macro within our macro editor online, you weren't dealing with proper syntax or anything else. It was simply a recording of keystrokes, and the keystrokes were interpreted into the command names, so you didn't have to do any mental type of conversions in your mind. And then we added to that concept to give it flexibility, where we had a macro options menu that allowed you to do conditional statements, ifs and ors and so on, for those that are inclined to do that type of thing. But once again, they didn't have to worry about the syntax of placing commands in quotes and brackets and indentation and so on. It was all point and shoot in the menu. You would move across the menu of the macro recorder to if, and you would get a drop-down list box that would say, that would be anything related to if. For example, if my cursor is at this location, or if the color on the screen is this. And you say, that's what I want. So it was all written out in plain English. And you would just point and shoot to that, and it would record it that way and show it in the editor. So that you could do powerful types of tasks without having to become an engineer in the process.
What sort of support will Window Bridge 2000 have for Internet Explorer and web surfing? Because that seems to be an area where screen readers are really shooting it out right now.
Yes. We are fully compatible with MSAA, and we use MSAA as an enhancement to our own inherent capabilities, so that when you go into IE, you automatically will have your screens read to you. You can, if you look at what Window Bridge, the very latest versions currently on the market, are capable of, you will see that you have a wide diversity of choices, where we don't just tie into MSAA and say there it will do everything that MSAA does. It brings up in our control panel, you have a dialogue that gives you specific control over every single aspect of what you would like to have read or not read to you. If you want something to tell you that it is a link, you can have it say that or not say that. You can have it automatically read just the first screen, or you can have it read and automatically scroll the screen. And then as soon as you tap a key, it automatically synchronizes your mouse pointer with the last thing you heard on that web page. It automatically decolonizes and reads in natural reading order. It allows you, once you've looked at something like a newspaper column, you can navigate back in natural order, saying I want to go column to the left or read up or down the current column, and then once it gets to the top of the current column, subsequently moving up will wrap to the bottom of the column to the left of it. And you can turn all these features on and off yourself.
What about pricing for Window Bridge 2000? I guess is the Windows 2000 version slightly more expensive than the 95-98 version?
Yes. We haven't finalized the pricing yet. We'll be posting that on our website in September. The official release for the product is scheduled for the first week of October, and we will have a full functioning product on our website, so that when you download it, the one beautiful thing about the new product, Jonathan, is it's one set of files for all the environments. Oh. So if I download a demo, that demo will work in Windows 95, 98, NT4, and Windows 2000. Now, if I purchase a licensed version of the product, and I purchase just the version for Windows 95 and 98, I can still install it for NT4 and 2000 and run it as a demo. So I don't have to, and then I can upgrade at any time. And it will just add the license to support the other environment.
Right, so it's actually the license information that enables it for the different operating systems.
That's correct.
Yeah.
So you everything is going to be supported under one set of files. So, and the interface is identical. The command structure, everything is identical. So once you become familiar with Window Bridge in one environment, it behaves exactly the same in all the others.
And 3.1, presumably support for that has been discontinued.
Yes, because 3.1 had physical limitations that would not allow us to unify how the interface would work in cross-platforms.
Yeah, that's a very interesting concept. So presumably you can buy one mega license, as you said earlier, and that enables it for all operating systems supported.
Yes. So we think by doing that, we can make it more economical to the user.
What are your upgrade policies like in terms of pricing generally?
Well, whenever we upgraded within a version number, within version 1.x, all of our updates were free. And when we came out with Windows 95, 98 support, all the updates within version 2 were free. And the cost of the upgrade from version 1 to 2 at the time was $200 US. and now we're going from version 2, I guess, to the equivalent of version 3, but it's not, because it's not an update. It's a total rewrite. However, as far as pricing to the customer is concerned, we will be offering a number of different things. We will be offering it in terms of anybody who has version 1 or 2 of Window Bridge will be able to pay an update-related range in price to get the brand-new product for $95.98. And we will also allow them to update from version 1 or 2 to the Windows NT and 2000 product. And we will also support trade-ins of other screen readers.
Oh, goodness.
And give them, those users, an upgrade type of pricing, where the cost of the product will probably be about 50% of normal.
Oh, how will that trade-in work? You'll actually have to physically send you the master disk, or is that how it would work?
Yes, we're just finalizing these things now, but I believe as it stands, the way the policies are being designed is you'll send us your master disk, and you will get our CD and license and all the documentation, the cassettes for tutorials and the whole bundle couriered back to you.
That's very interesting, and I guess that's another example of how you're doing your best to improve your marketing.
Yes. We feel that we want to expose Window Bridge to as many people as possible, and we want it to become affordable for those people, and we're trying to keep the price down. And I think when they take a look at the approach that was used in the new design and the ease of use, you'd be hard-pressed to find something you cannot do with Window Bridge with one finger.
There was some comment in the lists, you know, there probably still is from time to time, that says that people don't really want the DOS support. For instance, they might like what Window Bridge is doing in Windows, but they're quite happy to stick with their JAWS for DOS or Vocalize or ASAP or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any kind of discount available for people who might not want the DOS product that you'll be shipping with?
The DOS product is basically thrown in for free.
Okay.
Because it really doesn't have, we're not selling the product on its own. It's basically put in there to give people that level of access. Where it becomes a little tricky is when you deal with software-based speech. No one else has been able to make software-based speech fully work in a DOS environment, and we have. If you go to a DOS prompt and then load WordPerfect 5.1, we still have software-based speech working.
Irrespective of what speech. So it could be Microsoft Speech or FlexTalk or whatever.
Yeah, or Access 32, Text Assist.
Yeah.
And people said, you're not supposed to be able to do that. Even Microsoft said.
Well, then they should know. The only example I have of software speech working in DOS other than Window Bridge is that I believe Keynote Gold Multimedia works with Vocalize, but that's the only one that I'm aware of.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we've been able to extend that to all the software-based speech products.
Right.
So we're just working on that aspect now in the beta process, and we hope that we can maintain that as we have in our current version of Window Bridge 2.56. So for the person that needs to go to DOS to do occasional things, they're not going to have to worry about having a separate hardware synthesizer to achieve those tasks.
And who's going to want to upgrade to Windows 2000? I mean, is someone at home going to want to do that, or do you think this is going to be a corporate operating system?
No, I think that what Microsoft's plan was, and we kind of sniffed this out back in the early 90s, was that Windows 3.1, 95, and 98 were only hand-holding tactics on behalf of Microsoft to gradually move people into feeling comfortable with a full 32-bit environment of NT in 2000, and that they felt that the quantum leap from first getting somebody introduced to a graphic environment and then saying, oh, by the way, we're discontinuing that, you're going to have to go to NT, it was going to be quite a culture shock for the users, and it was also going to be a real nightmare for the software manufacturers. So what they did was they progressively, in their marketing plan behind the scenes, changed the operating system to lead people by the hand right toward the NT in 2000 environment. And by doing that, they created a frenzy in the market with software developers to write 32-bit applications. And now that there is an enormous diversity in what you can purchase as applications under Windows running 32-bit, they're now moving toward the eventual step where they'll just cut off after Millennium comes out, which people are now starting to talk about for next year, which is going to be the upgrade to Windows 98. You'll see that everything is going to be set for 32-bit, and then Microsoft, we believe, are going to be working on their 64-bit environment.
So there is one more major upgrade to Windows 98 expected?
Yes. Yes.
And when is that due?
It's called Millennium, and it's going to be mid-next year, I believe.
Yeah, if we've all still got computers that work by then, of course.
Yes, but I think that there's going to be a real problem when they move to a 64-bit environment, because none of the PCs are going to work.
Yes, what a charming thought. As somebody who's just sitting down to buy a Pentium 500 in the next few days, I'd hate to think that all that money was was for nothing.
Well, I think it'll be, this is just my guess, I don't have any official knowledge, but I think you're probably looking at 2003 or 2004 before the 64-bit processors are ready, along with a coinciding operating system.
Oh, well,
but we all know that it'll never just stop, and 32-bit is going to become too limiting to people, which I laugh, because my very first computer was only capable of spelling words. It looked like an IBM Selectric typewriter. It had a one-line 40-character display. It didn't have a numeric pad for navigation. It ran odd magnetic tapes for storage. It ran at just under 1 megahertz. One magnetic tape could hold 20K of information, so that if you had an application, like a word processing program, it had to be written in that time or in that size constraint, and your data would have to fit on a 20K magnetic tape. And so I used to do database work and word processing and fill out forms where it would only read things back to me a character at a time. But for me, it was still faster than using Braille. And I think that device was $23,000 US.
Yeah, yep. And it's precisely because of that legacy, which is surprisingly prevalent, that every byte was so crucial that we've got into the Y2K mess that we have.
Yes, well, it's interesting, because it was because of those limitations that my programming skills were focused on assembler.
Right.
Because you could do machine-level coding in a very, very tight space.
What's your take on the situation with Microsoft and the screen reader industry, just before we wrap up? Because, you know, there are some who say that Microsoft is the bad guy, that one day they're going to take over the screen reader world and release their own product. People have different views on active accessibility and its usefulness and its capture of the market. How do you feel about Microsoft at the moment in the future?
Well, we feel that Microsoft is not going to make a move to put out their own screen reader for a number of reasons. One of which is, I don't think they want to jump into the rat's nest of support that their accessibility division is more geared toward providing tools to allow these products to be developed. It's too small a market for Microsoft. It's not a moneymaker on Microsoft's level to do that. They have a couple of tools like the Magnify program that comes with Windows now that gives you some screen enlargement, and the Narrator program that gives you some speech, but they are not meant at all to be a full screen reader or a screen enlarger. They're more of a demonstration tool to see what is possible in their environment. And I really don't think that, even though people thought that following the road that IBM did with their screen reader, you notice that as soon as IBM came out with their screen reader for OS 2, the screen reader market died. Nobody else bothered to write anything. And there was no growth in that area of the screen reader market. I think that having and trying to advocate for several different screen readers putting out products creates an environment of creativity and competitiveness where it's not going to come out as a product and say, there, that's all you get, that's all we feel like doing, and that's it. And I think that if Microsoft put out a product, that they wouldn't have the incentive to constantly evolve the program on a regular basis to give it more and more capabilities. They would say, there, this gets around our legal requirements as far as making an environment accessible so that we can turn around and sell more copies of Windows and Windows applications. That's where their money is, and that's where their market is. And as long as there are screen reader companies that are willing to stay up all night and bang their head against the wall and curse and swear about the lack of standards or lack of consistency in the environment, then they'll pass on the headaches to the screen reader companies and let us deal with the small niche markets. That's just our feeling on the current situation.
How about active accessibility? This is something that I've talked to other screen reader vendors about. There are some who say that really what we should be lobbying for are adherence to basic Windows practices. If you have a standard dialog box or an edit field or rich edit or whatever, there's no problem. And instead, some people think that we've been dragged into this active accessibility thing, which is almost holding us back in some ways, given the very few applications that Microsoft have implemented MSAA in. What's your feeling on active accessibility? Is it a hit or a miss?
Well, right now, I think it's got very limited use. It does have some interesting use within Internet Explorer. I think that it's very unfortunate that Microsoft has not been able to convince their various divisions that MSAA should be a standard. And our understanding of the situation is each division of Microsoft makes their own policy decisions for applications under their jurisdiction. For instance, the business group takes care of programming languages and so on. And a couple of years ago, they said no, they had no inclination to adhere to MSAA standards whatsoever. Now they're thinking about it and discussing it and saying that they might adhere to it.
Oh, well, that's very good of them, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
why doesn't somebody like Bill Gates, who jumped on the active accessibility, well, the accessibility bandwagon generally, actually issue a directive that says unless a product is accessible through MSAA, it doesn't go out? I mean, surely it's as simple as that.
It would be. I think that with the court cases that are going on in the U.S. now regarding Microsoft, if the government is successful in breaking Microsoft up, you will see those divisions become entirely new entities, in which case it will be far less viable that they will be able to implement MSAA standards into each of their divisions. I think that if the companies stayed together, that Gates and the upper echelon would have, whether they would pursue it or not, I don't know. I can't speak for them. But they would have an environment where they really could force the use of the standards. But they are... I only get a small insight into what actually happens design-wise within Microsoft. But at one point, there was one person within the accessibility division that would attend the meetings of all the other divisions when it came to product design. And he would jump up and down and yell and scream saying, you've got to understand the presence of MSAA, what it's there for. It's not going to negatively impact on the application. You've got to look at keyboard equivalents for every command and take these things into consideration. And whether that division and that programming group decided to adhere to that standard would be based on the effectiveness of that one person attending these design meetings and getting the point across.
So we've got a bit of a window of opportunity here, if you pardon the pun. We've got this window of opportunity with the possibility of Microsoft being broken up. Do you think, as a blind person, that some of the major consumer organizations are a bit soft on Microsoft?
I really don't know how to interpret how they react to situations. I've seen some very unconventional decisions, but I've seen some of the most ridiculous decisions that, from our perspective and insight into what's going on, just doesn't make sense. It really does seem to be a simple standard to say, look, when you're developing the next generation of Word, why not take these things into consideration? It's not going to cause any problems whatsoever, but it's going to help enormously. And yet it almost seems like these divisions are saying, I don't know anybody who's blind, never mind disabled, so I really can't relate to their problems, but if you're telling me that there are companies out there that are writing ways around this, let them do it. Why should we?
So Zen,
and it's very frustrating. It really is.
Yeah.
That's why we are trying to remain as independent as we can and design things on our own as much as we can.
And taking advantage of active accessibility when there's merit in doing so for the customer.
Yes, and then at the same time, designing our own enhancements so that it doesn't... there are companies in the screen readers that say, no, we will not support MSA. There are others that say we rely on it extensively or exclusively. We've taken a middle-of-the-road approach saying, here's what we can get out of the application on our own, and here are little things that we can code in that will give you that information. However, we can enhance that even further in some respects with MSAA. So where MSAA is able to achieve more than we are, we recommend the use of that feature for MSAA, and that goes back to the dialogue that allows you to turn on and off specific features. It allows the user to have more control over exactly what's spoken or shown in Braille and when, so they can control the verbosity and the level of feedback instead of just tying in and saying, there, we read the technical documentation on MSAA, every bit of information it gives, we hook into, and you'll get that information. Because you get a lot of duplication, there are bugs in MSAA, and it becomes crude at points in time in its output. We give the user the ability to say, no, I don't want to use MSAA. Yes, I do want to use MSAA. Or maybe there are things about an MSAA I'd like to try. So we put that decision back in the hands of the user and don't preclude its use by saying, sorry, as a policy, we're not going to, or we're going to exclusively support it.
Ending on a positive note, when you look on some of the email lists around the place, Window Bridge or Synthevoice in particular gets a lot of kudos for its technical support, and it's quite interesting that you say there are so few of you, because I know that when I've looked at demos of Window Bridge and sent a help message, I think I can say that your response is one of the most timely in the industry. How do you manage to do that? You must be up at all sorts of hours looking at your email.
Yes, but if I'm going to assume the position within the company of directing the flow of the product, I'm not going to sit in an ivory tower and say, just because I'm blind, this is the way that blind are going to do things, and I think this is the best. So I spend about 6 or 7 hours a day doing the email myself. I read every single message. I reply sometimes to the list or more times than often in private to the user. I document every single idea that comes in, as outrageous as it may seem, and we've got our list of we'd like to publish a book. We've had people saying, do you have a command that will make it read every second word? We've had really bizarre requests for features, but we document the author, the date, the category it falls into, whether it's navigation, control panel, narration, installation, whatever the case may be, and then it's from that feedback that we have daily brief meetings along with technical support who are constantly answering email as well. We've probably taken our direction and where other companies have put the focus and financial resources into marketing, we've put it into the technical support. We didn't feel comfortable that someone would buy the product because they heard so much about it through our marketing techniques and then found that they were left on their own. We felt that we hoped that our users would be satisfied with the quality of the product and with the technical support we could give, and that they would become a vehicle for spreading the word to other blind individuals that here's a company that will stand behind the product and will support it after the fact and will listen to the feedback. I think the comments have been made recently that about 75% of the new features in Window Bridge in the last year or 2 years have been based on discussions and suggestions that have been put forward on our list. So we just chose that as our directive and our mandate to do that. And I look, as a blind consumer, I like to know that I could purchase a product and try to get to know it and say, well, gee, you guys missed the boat on this one, or whatever, and give constructive feedback to a company and have them say, great, great idea. We'll see how we can put this into the next version or when we do a rewrite or whatever the case may be, that at least my ideas are not being shot down or ignored.